few more people will come and join us. What I want to do today is to look at a wave function picture, so a wave packet picture of the neutron interferometer. And let's remember what we've done so far. So we've taken the neutron interferometer, we've looked at it, of course, unitarily, and it's trivial. We've looked at it with noise. We found that we could describe that if we kept the noise distribution, and that we could describe it more compactly by a superoperator distribution. And that's all good and fine. The superoperator distribution is useful for telling us what the overall map is, but it fails to tell us how to develop the physics. And as an example of that, imagine that we take the neutron interferometer, and I tell you that I'm particularly interested in the noise that has some particular value of epsilon. So, okay, I really want to know about that particular noise. And what I could do, of course, is I could add a phase flag, and I could compensate for that epsilon, and I could guarantee that for any one value of epsilon, that I would send the neutrons to this detector based upon that. But of course, I couldn't uniquely send them to that detector. I would send them to that detector, plus I would send a whole slew of other neutrons that wouldn't have probability one of reaching that detector, but would have a very high probability of reaching that detector. And so this particular error model, although the phase stores the information of the error, it doesn't allow us to select out the errors that we want. It doesn't allow us to probe the distribution of errors as precisely as we would like. All we see is a loss of contrast. I want to differentiate that. I'm going to take now our errors, I'm going to store them in other degrees of freedom, not the degree of phase. So we have two other degrees of freedom that are convenient here. I could store the error information in the spin of the neutron. And that is perhaps the cleanest. I'm going to show you that next week. Today, I'm going to store it in the momentum of the neutron. Now, we have to be careful here, because if we think about the momentum of the neutron, through the neutron interferometer, is, of course, determined by the acceptance of the interferometer, that we have a Bragg condition, and we have to fulfill that Bragg condition. And so if we keep, I think that was the coordinate system we used, we can't take and use the xy axis to store momentum. But that's all right. I'm going to store it in the z coordinate of momentum. Because the z coordinate, the interferometer is pretty forgiving. That we have our planes, remember their planes are running this way. And if I tilt the beam of the neutrons out a little bit, that's okay. They'll still be accepted by the interferometer. And let me draw over here how we actually do this. So we have a guide for neutrons. We put a graphite crystal in here. So the neutrons are going that way. Here, in a Bragg scattering, we get the neutrons we want out. So these are 2.7 or whatever. And there's a spread of this. This looks like a point source. We then put a focusing monochromator in there. So it's a series of crystal blades that focuses this beam down. So the looks like that. It focuses the beam down onto our three-blade monochromator. And so you can see this is the z direction. So I've tilted the monochromator from that picture so that we see z here. And you can see that there's a range of momenta entering into the interferometer. And of course, we do that because we would like occasionally to see a neutron at the detector. And so I use this to increase the flux of neutrons impinging on the detector. Okay. So now we're going to look at, well, just to remind you, I have this neutron beam coming in. I'm going to create a wave packet of it. If the neutron beam had one momentum, then I would have a wave packet that looks like a plane wave. Here, I have a distribution of momentum, so I can define this distribution of the kz momentum in terms of a probability distribution. And now the wave packet is simply going to be the incoherent superposition of the waves associated with this distribution. Okay? And so since I'm adding up a number of waves, then what wave functions, what we'll see is a peaked wave function in space. So let's do that. Now, the we need to think a little bit about the potential here. And so if you'll allow me to define a generalized wave number. Oh, yeah, sorry.
The neutrons in the interferometer will be very spread out in z momentum. Will you still have a thin beam in like x, y momentum?
Yeah. So let me give you some. Thanks for the question. Let me give you some dimensions. This crystal is about 2 by 2 centimeters. This distance here is about 3 meters. This spread is 4 centimeters. This distance is about 2 meters. And when we enter here, the beam here is 2 millimeters by 8 millimeters. And it doesn't, the variation in the z momentum is actually about a little bit less than 2% of the total momentum of the neutron going through there. So in fact, it's just a misleading figure because I didn't draw the dimensions right. And so it really is almost flat. Oh, much less. Much less. Thanks for the question. Okay. So now then, we define a generalized wave vector, which is just going to be the energy and the potential of that the neutron feels. And of course, the potential is going to vary over space, and that's going to be important. The potential is the optical potential that we talked about before for the coherent function, but it could be the magnetic potential, it could be the gravitational potential that you looked at, any of those things. And so, you know, now we have the Schrodinger's equation. Rewritten in this convenient form, the nice thing about having this generalized momentum is if we compare that to a normal wave equation, to any wave equation, we can define an index of refraction. And so in the 40s, Halpern defined the index of refraction as a ratio of the change in momenta as we change the potential. Okay? So the potential is changing as we go from one material to the other. And we can see this is nicely has a form that looks like the potential divided by the energy. And it's the square root of that. Okay, so now then we have a potential. Of course, we can We can define Snell's law. And the normal thing in 1 sine theta is equal to n2 sine theta. But the velocities, of course, change as well. You know, just like the angles change, the velocities change. And so now we have this nice picture. It says, OK, I put some material in the neutron interferometer. Let's take this blade. Well, what really happens? What really happens is there's a small change in that path. But the outgoing beam, of course, is parallel to the unshifted beam, right? And so we can think about measuring an effective coherence function at this point, that we have two wave packets of the neutron beam coming together, and they're shifted. And how can we shift them? Well, we can shift them transversely, as I showed here, which is what we normally do with the phase blade, with the phase flag. Or I can shift them in time. I can carefully put a region of space that's exactly perpendicular to this, and now I'll shift it in time. And it's very convenient to do that with the magnetic field. So that piece is often done. Or I can shift it out of the plate. And today we're going to talk about shifting it out of the plate, out of the beam, because there the coherence length is going to be the largest. We'll be able to shift the wave packet really quite a long ways from each other, still have the neutrons diffract properly across here, recombine, and look at the interference behavior at this point. Okay, and by shifting the neutrons out of the plane, then we'll be able to label the errors by the momentum. And we'll see how that all combines. All right. Now, it's useful to note that if I look at this function, for thermal neutrons, this is about 1 minus 1 part in 10 to 5. So this is really, really small. And that's a little bit of a drag, because you would like to think that you could have a critical angle. Remember that under Snell's law, we can have a critical angle, and we can have total reflection. We can't have total reflection in thermal neutrons, except for angles of about 0.3 degrees. So when we build these neutron guides, we try to arrange the momentum so that it's very close to being along the guide direction. And we have internal reflection, but to keep the neutrons in the guide. But that's only true to the layer of 0.3. So they have to become a really grazing angle onto the walls of the guide to keep in there. All right. Now, I want to be able to control the offset of the neutrons. And having a phase flag, we could control the offset of the neutrons by rotating the phase flag. We certainly do that. But when we do that, we change the phase as well. And I'd like to have a simpler way of doing that. And so our approach is to have two prisms that we're going to change the separation between. So I'm going to change this distance in the neutron beam. And you can see, if I can draw this correctly, which is probably not the case, okay, it's too bad I chose such a big angle. Pretend that this goes up some more. All right, so that would be my separation, dz. right? So at the end of the day, we haven't changed the momentum. What we've done is we've translated the beam over. And we've done that by an amount delta z. And of course, by pushing these together and pulling them apart, I can change the amount of time it spends in here, so I can change that separation. Yeah.
Like if you send the beam through the prisms at a certain angle, the beam won't translate at all?
So if I sent the beams through here, right, and then at this level it wouldn't, but then coming out of here it would. So yes, if you apply Snell's law, you'll see that the beam is entirely displaced. Okay.
Okay. Oh, that thing is just a guide.
Right.
AI. Okay.
Yeah.
And the angular shifts will be the same going in.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
If the beam is horizontal coming in, it will go horizontal.
I do work that out in the notes.
Okay.
And I think you have these.
Yeah.
So. Good. Okay, so now then we've got our neutron interferometer and we put the prisms. Again, the prisms are rotated 90 degrees from the way I show them, but I'm going to put them this way so that I can, just as a pictorial thing to keep track of. So when we look at recombining the neutron beams at this point, when we recombine them, they're combined with the displacement dz. And they have some momentum kz with the probability of kz. And so we're going to pick up a phase error as we combine those two. Think about it now as just plane waves. We'll integrate over it and see the wave packet in a second. But these are just two plane waves. So they're separated by an amount kz, and so there's a phase angle between them, and that angle is exactly dz kz. And so we can combine these, and we'll have that the wave function coming. Yeah?
So kz is the difference between the two?
No, we haven't changed the momentum of the neutron beam. So the neutron beam comes in, but this slope and this slope are exactly the same. Thanks. All right, so we have the wave packet. Oops. Call that alpha. We still have a phase flag, so there's still that term there. E to the I k z, and then that is z. I should never change my notation as I'm writing on the board, but I often do. There's our wave packet. So our wave packet says, yep, we have some phase shift associated with the position. This global phase shift, of course, is boring. That's one we'll just take out. The one that matters is this difference that enters in, just like the phase shift we would introduce on a phase flag. But it's dependent upon this displacement. It's dependent upon that shift. OK, we'll see how that makes a difference in this case. So now we can integrate over this. We can look at, we can project onto the 0-0 state, look at the contrast. We'll see a loss of contrast. And that loss of contrast is going to look just like a phase error. So right now, all we've done is to introduce a new phase error, just as we did before, but OK, in terms of a wave packet picture of the dynamics. And if you look, yeah, you don't have the notes with you, but I'm on page 9 of the notes. There's an error. Let me just show you this, because I don't. It drove me crazy this morning looking at this thing and saying, why couldn't that be? So when I go and integrate over this distribution, I get this result when I increase that distribution, where I just take this probability distribution to be Gaussian, just as we have before. I say we have a Gaussian distribution. And the obium comes down to 0. And you think, well, that can't be right. It has to be going towards 0.5. And the reason is not shown on the board. The reason's right here, that I'm not integrating over the full width of the distribution. I changed this in my notes. In yours, this is narrower. And so I define distribution by only integrating over a little piece of it. So in your notes, change that, because otherwise, and you will see that this goes towards 0.5. Otherwise, it looks like we have a change in the probability transmission coefficient probability, which is the wrong physics. Okay, so that's on page 9. I'll send you a new version of it. Now, let's make sure we understand this before I then take the next step. So now, I shift this beam over. It has a momentum distribution. We're going to integrate over the momentum distribution. And I want to take a few examples first. Let's say that P of kz is a delta function. Yeah?
I'm a little confused about what's causing the phase shift.
What's causing the phase shift is, think about that, having a plane wave that I've shifted those two relative to each other. So if I have a periodic structure, there's no shift. They should recombine, like so. OK, now I could change, of course, this phase to shift them, right? So I could do that. But now I'm actually just displacing them. And so what's the phase that I see? Well, it's the periodicity, which is k times at that separation.
OK, so if the beam came flat onto the prism, there's no phase shift?
Yeah.
OK.
So if the prisms were flat together, there's no phase shift. OK? So go through the prisms. You've seen that in Physics 1, and look at them more carefully. Okay, the prisms are translating the beam uniformly. Okay, so now if I have a delta function as my probability distribution, and I shift these beams relative to each other, and I look at the outcoming state, what is this outgoing, what's the wave function of that outgoing state?
Zero.
Yeah. So you're saying here that we have, you're trying to say the same thing, I think. You're saying, we've got a superposition, 1 over the square root of 2, so I'm going to normalize it by throwing away that blade, that beam, where I have, of course, the neutron is in the 0-0 state, but it has a displacement, delta z equals 0. Let me save myself some space here. plus 0, 0, delta z is equal to delta z. It's a horrible notation. I have a superposition of the non-displaced and the displaced field. And it's a coherent superposition of the particles coming out.
Does that follow from having
the It does, because if I...
No, I mean, but how?
Since because I have a plane wave, so regardless of how I've separated them, there's only one wave that I'm combining, so there's a phase that I can define. If I integrate over this, and this is not a plane wave, right, then this part is going to decohere. And so then I would no longer have this. If I have this delta, this probability distribution broad, then the outcoming state is going to be I'm going to leave the same notation. I don't like it, but right. I would lose the coherence in the system, and I would have an incoherent distribution of the neutrons in those two locations. Yeah? So
the second line is if a delta function, or?
No, the second line is if it's a broad distribution, so that this term has a set of random phases in it. Yeah? Please.
What is
delta z? What kind of delta z? For our experiments, it goes up to 1,000 angstroms.
But when you say it's delta z or delta z, and I know that the generation between 0 and 1, so what is delta z?
Delta z is the separation of the neutron beam. Right? So I'm shifting the neutron beam, and I'm shifting that by some continuous amount from 0 experimentally up to about 1,000 angstroms. And as I shift that beam, okay, then I have to create a new basis set. And that new basis set says, hey, I shifted the beam in this path, I didn't shift the beam in that path. And so if I looked here, so I've got the blade, and I've got two beams coming in. I've got one beam coming in from the shifted one, and another beam coming in from the non-shifted here. So I have the shifted and the unshifted. And what happens? Well, if they're close enough together that they coherently interact with one another, right? And I see an interference effect. And I would get out a beam which is a coherent superposition of those two. What happens if they're so far away that they're incoherent? Well, then they diffract separately. And so this goes back to this example we had in the first class where I just block the beam. So then this beam would be diffracted into both paths. This beam would be diffracted into both paths. We would have neutrons in both paths, but there would be no coherence between them. So if we can combine those again, and that's how we find out if there's coherence. We have to combine the two beams. We combine them again. We wouldn't see any interference effects. Yeah? Okay. Now then, let's do two things. One, let's measure here the contrast curve versus the separation. Now, if the two beams come in and there's no coherence between them, then there's no contrast curve, right? Because each beam is sending half of its, with probability 1/2, the neutrons to O or H. And so the contrast, so once I get out here, I no longer have coherence out here. So I've measured the contrast versus the separation. And once I'm out here, then we've taken those beams and they no longer interfere. Of course, when the separation is small, then we see that there's contrast. And in this particular case, it falls off after a few hundred angstroms. Okay. Now, what I want to show you is that out here, we can return that contrast. Okay? So how do we return that contrast? I'm going to select out the momentum. I don't want to see all of the momentum distribution because I should have written the equation on the other board. But remember, the equation had a term that looked like the phase was dz times k. And we're averaging over k. And the reason we lose our contrast is that dz times k, that over that distribution, wraps around 2 pi many times. If I choose k to be narrow, then fine, dz times k will be a phase. It won't be an incoherence. And so here's the experiment. We have our system with the two prisms. Forget about the sample. And I put another crystal in here to diffract. But now I've oriented that crystal so that I'm diffracting along the z direction. So whereas these crystals have Bragg scattering in the xy plane, this crystal has a Bragg scattering in the z axis. And so the piece that's scattered to our detector is selective for the z element of momentum. And it is noisy data. I apologize for that, but not very much. It was hard to get anyways. And if we look at the contrast versus the prism separation, so now I've put the separation in millimeters, but it goes out to, this is about 1,000 angstroms here. You can see that in the case where we've selected out the momentum, the contrast is preserved. In the case where we've looked at the full range of momentum, the contrast falls off. Yeah? Okay. And the reason, again, is here, that if I choose this to be narrow, this piece doesn't look like a random face. Okay. We'll get through there. So that experiment is called post-selection. That says, take the experimental part, add in here a filter so that we're only looking at, see if I can do this correctly, so that we're only looking at a narrow range of momentum. So with this filter, we have a new narrower momentum distribution in Z, carry out exactly the same entry rule, and see that we recover the contrast. Now, I want to show you a more elegant way of doing this calculation. This is pretty clunky. But it's useful in that it keeps the momentum distribution. But before I do that, I want to reinforce the whole idea by looking at different momentum distributions. So we said that we had this focusing monochromator here. And this focusing monochromator has 9 little blades, little crystals, and we rotate each of those crystals so that the diffraction condition for each of those, with that as the starting beam, ends up with the neutrons coming here. And it's relatively easy for us to put a piece of cadmium in front of those blades. And remember that what cadmium does is it absorbs all neutrons. So we can separate we can look separately at different momentum distributions just by our choice of how many cadmium blocks we put into the system. So there's the figure again. Here's the momentum distributions that we measure. So if I have one blade, this is the intensity versus the variation in momentum. So this is kz, the z component of the momentum divided by the total momentum that the neutron has. So that's the square roots of kx, ky, and kz, each squared, of course. And you can see that 1% is over here, right? So it's a pretty narrow distribution. In the case, we only have the one blade. Yep.
One blade meaning on the focusing?
Meaning the focusing one, but I've only kept the center one of the focusing one.
All right.
And so we have this. And the shape of it is effectively given by the Debye equation for a temperature defects of that crystal. Okay, that's not interesting, but you can see it's not this smooth. We add 5 blades, we get this distribution. I add 9 blades, we get the outer distribution. And you can easily see that experimentally it looks exactly like we've added a bunch of crystals together, right? Because it's not smooth, they're finite crystals. We've added this. We get the calculations. And there is the momentum distribution. There's the contrast related to the momentum distribution. So here we've plotted the contrast. This is the separation of the beams here going only up to 300 angstroms. If I only have that first blade, then of course the momentum distribution is narrow, and so we can separate the beams further before dz, kz becomes important, right? And so we see this high contrast curve. If I put all 9 blades, then the contrast falls off quickly, and these bumps should be there. That's because there's a periodic structure in that momentum spectrum. And so basically this is the Fourier transform of the momentum spectrum. And for condensed matter physics, it's actually a useful experiment to measure the momentum spectra this way. Now, let me ask you the question before I show you the data. So now I take that 9 blade case. And we modify it to have 2 sets of prisms here. Okay, and so I'm going to define dz1 and dz2 as the displacement of the beam as I shift, as I move the prisms apart, the beam gets displaced. And I can displace it in the upper path and then the lower path. And if I look at the contrast versus dz1, leaving dz2 equal to 0, then we see a contrast curve. Of course, if I do the other contrast versus dz2 and leave dz1 equal to 0, I see this. And then the question is, if I plot the contrast dz1 equal to, let's take a value here, let's just call this x. Okay, but then I vary dz2, what do I see? Yeah?
There should be a maximum contrast where dz2 is approximately x.
That's exactly right. So that here, what we see, let me move that over so I can. What we see is a contrast curve that looks like, pretend it looks the same as those. That looks like this. Okay? And so we haven't introduced decoherence simply by putting the prism there. And that was an important question. By putting the prism there, did we introduce so much noise by the prism itself that what we were seeing was a loss of contrast, not due to the separation of the prisms, but just due to the presence of the prisms? And here we can see that if that isn't the case, because I can shift over in one, I can shift over in the other, and realign the beams. Once I realign the beams, then the contrast is recovered. You had a question.
So because the wavefronts are like periodic in the beam, it seems like the contrast loss should also be periodic, like if you shift it far enough.
Well, remember that we have a distribution of momentum.
Oh, okay, right.
So
if you shift it far enough, one of the momenta will realign, but the other momenta will still be signed. Yes, okay.
Yeah, because it's a continuous distribution. If it wasn't, and you know, I asked, one of the questions in the notes is to say, consider an incoming case where we had two delta functions in momentum, and then we would see these periodic structures exactly as you're alluding to. And here's the experiment. So we've separated, we've got two axes here, contrast separations of the wedge in path two and separations of the wedge in path one. And here we see the normal thing. Okay? If we take the path one to zero and I shift the other beam, we lose our contrast. But if I take the separation in one path to some finite quantity and then I shift the other, we see nicely that the contrast builds and it decays. And it is roughly symmetric as it should be. Yeah. So there's actually coherence in this system. Even though we've lost our contrast, it can be recovered. It can be recovered both by a post-selection, and it can be recovered by reshifting the beams. Yeah?
It says there that your path one separation is minus 4 millimeters, but the path two is at positive 4 millimeters?
We're shifting them the same way.
So that's just how you've chosen your coordinates?
Yeah. Okay. I'd have to. I always have a hard time paying attention at the board here. But when this, the separation between the two of them are the same and they're both 4 millimeters, this is what we get.
Just wanted to make sure there wasn't something tremendously odd going on.
There's nothing tremendously odd. Experiments are always tremendously simple. Okay. So now then, what we're going to do in this time that I've not left myself is I want to describe a quasi-probability distribution function called the Wigner function. So it's a quasi-probability function in phase space. There are lots of these. But this one is widely used. It's not necessarily better than any of the other ones. We're going to describe a probability function in position and momentum. And the marginal probability is going to be correct. So if I want to make a measurement in neutron interferometry, we make a measurement if I'm putting my helium-3 detector here. I'm making a measurement in real space. I'm accepting all neutrons regardless of what their momenta is. So if I want to make a measurement, I'm going to integrate this quasi-probability distribution over momentum. So I'll have a probability as a function of z is equal to the integral of the Wigner function over kz. Okay. And that will give us the correct pieces. Now, the advantage of looking at these quasi-probability functions is we're going to have a map of the dynamics over k, over the momentum, and z. And so then when I come back and say, no, I don't want to put my helium-3 detector here. I'm going to put this crystal first and then the helium-3 detector. I can say, oh, well, this crystal is going to select out just this region of momentum space. And then I can take the same quasi-probability distribution, and I can calculate a new outcome from it. And so here we have all of the features we need. Now, the Wigner representation, the Wigner function, is effectively a Fourier transform. Of a displaced operator. The displacement gives us the momentum piece in this piece, in this feature.
So
e to the I z prime k. Okay? And so we're getting out the function of k and z integrating over z prime. Now, if I have a Gaussian wave packet, of course, then we can do this analytically. And so that's easy. And if I save it here, if I quickly write down the analytics of that, the Wigner function for two displaced Gaussians, that's what we have coming out of here. We have a Gaussian wave packet. We have a Gaussian momentum distribution here. I've got a Gaussian wave packet here. I've got another one. And they're shifted from each other by dz. OK, so we're going to have the Wigner function normalized I need to define the width of the momentum distribution because I need to define that Gaussian wave packet. So delta is the width in momentum space of this probability distribution kz. Okay, so that's just the second moment of the Gaussian. So we have this term. So these two pieces look like, effectively, the waves moving in it, moving apart from each other. I have a wave located at z and a wave located at dz with some Gaussian structure. And then I'm going to have the interference term. And the interference term, of course, has to have the phase from the phase flag in it as well, right? So there's the interference of the separation of the beams plus the interference because of additive phase shift over those. And the whole thing, of course, has to have a Gaussian envelope to it, and it does. Yeah? You have a question? So the delta here is the width of the Gaussian distribution in momentum. So I have a P of kz, and it's that width there. This is just z of times delta. I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. So I have a function over z. Okay, and there's this piece and the shifted one. So these are the two wave packets. And then there's an interference term. And in momentum space, there's this Gaussian structure. Let me show you. K naught is 2 pi over lambda. So K naught is K naught of the incoming beam. Remember that's so the momentum is basically in the x y direction.
Yeah.
right? So that is the momentum in the xy direction. Okay. This is the easiest one to show you. So what I've plotted here, let me go back to dz equals 0. So what I've plotted here is the Wigner function. So this is z, and this is momentum. And at this point, dz is 0. So this is the Wigner function as the two beams are interacting with each other. And I'm going to spread those two beams apart. And as I spread the two beams apart, we see that there's interference effects that appear along the momentum direction. Remember that we're going to integrate over the momentum direction to see the intensity. If I go further apart, these build up, and the beams start to separate. You can see that the beams are becoming two distinct beams now. I increase dz some more. They separate further. And as they separate, we build up this interference structure in between. Okay, but now notice that this interference structure is coming from that cosine term. The cosine term goes as cosine dz times k. And so what we'll see is that this periodicity here is going to become finer and finer. If we integrate over this, it's going to eventually go to zero as we separate the beam. So let me separate the beam somewhat more and show you that. So now we've got two pretty well separated beams with this interference pattern in between. But as I integrate over that, this piece will go to zero. It's a quasi-probability distribution, of course, so it can be negative. I should have said that. Let's go further apart. So now you see that we've really separated the two beams. And if I go much further apart, the periodicity of this piece becomes higher and higher. The beams are fully separated. If I integrate it over this, if I integrate it over the momentum, project it down along the position axis, then I would see a peak. This would be zero. Integrates to zero. And here's another peak. And now what happens? If I have the two beams separated by a certain amount, but I want to see coherence, I've got to limit my momentum to half a lobe here. Right? So I have to choose my momentum filter to be very sharp. And the further apart I move these beams, the sharper I have to choose that to be. Okay? And here, the nice thing about the Wigner function is all the information is there. It tells us, in theory, what we can measure. And of course, we can just say, fine, my measurement's going to choose this slice of momentum. Or I just put a helium-3 detector. My measurement's going to choose the whole momentum. And we can trivially calculate what's going to happen. This distribution contains every bit of information that we would have if we kept the original momentum distribution. So here, by looking at the Wigner function, is effectively a Fourier transform of that original momentum distribution. Okay, so all of the, you know, we take a Fourier transform, you don't lose any information. All the information is here. We haven't lost anything. It's just a more pictorial way of seeing the dynamics. Let me just go to the full separation here. Okay, so there's the full separation that I calculated. So it's a separation of 1,000 angstroms. This is a reasonable simulation for the experiment, actually. And you can see that the lobes of this interference pattern are nearly as large, well, maybe larger, than the wave packets themselves, right? Because they get sharper and sharper as you move things away. The wave packet broadens, of course. All right. Here, from the Wigner function, I now calculate for you what you would see as a function of position at the O detector. So now we're integrating over momentum. In this case, I've integrated over all of the momentum. So put it up there where we can see it. So now, you have to be careful with what you're looking at here. You know, this looks nice. It says that I've got two beams coming in. Unfortunately, the resolution of the screen isn't great enough, but here's the interference fringes that we would see. There's the two beams going out. As the two beams get separated by a couple hundred angstroms, we lose the interference between them, and we no longer see a fringe. And of course, therefore, we would no longer see any contrast. Here, you know, you say, oh, we have a fringe. That fringe, of course, is going to be shifted by alpha. That would be shifted by the phase flat. And so there's contrast here. Here, there's no fringes. We change alpha. Nothing changes about this picture. It remains the same. Now, remember that this axis here is over a really small length scale, right? That axis says that at this point, I've shifted those over by 400 angstroms. So you can't take this as being, oh, I'll put a position-sensitive detector there and look at it. This picture is drawn saying that I have one infinitesimally narrow beam of neutrons going through my system. When I have this distributed beam of neutrons that's spread out over 8 millimeters, if I want to know what the picture is at the detector, then what I need to do is I need to convolve the shape of the beam with this, right? And so this picture of effectively the wave packet, right? This is what this is. It's effectively the wave packet as seen by the detector. This picture isn't close to the macroscopic physics. It's close to the microscopic physics of thinking about a wave packet. The macroscopic picture would smear this out, but it wouldn't lose these fringes, right? These fringes would all align with each other anyways. We'd still see the contrast in this region. Yeah? Okay, so that's... Is there no class following us today?
There is.
Oh, okay. It just seems like very quiet out there. So I guess we have to stop. So that's the picture. There's the Wigner function. We have a couple books that describe the development of the Wigner function. Basically, I think that the most useful piece of it is to take it as a Fourier transform of the wave packet information and to remember that it's a quasi-probability over phase space. And that's, so therefore, we have all of the information of our experiment represented here in one compact picture. Yes?
Because
there are positive and negative probabilities. So that's all. If you, there are similar distributions defined for classical probability distributions. And they almost have the same structure. And let me not try to invent to reconstruct it. This term is different in that case. The rest of it would be the same. Okay, my expectation, and I have to go back and check, is that it would be 1 plus this. Okay, but you know, there are classical probability distributions that also give correct marginals. But here, since we want to see interference, you know, we need to have the quasi-probability distribution. Okay.